stop funding legacy business models that are based on yesterday's economy or yesterday's economics, and start finding and investing in business models that are instead based on tomorrow's economy. I think that's as cleanly as you can say it.
Welcome to Sustainability Wired, the podcast that plugs into the thinking that moves sustainable finance. I'm Lorenzo Sa, the Chief Sustainability Officer at Clarity AI. And today I'm very excited to cover a topic as we end this year and start the next, is very much looking at what's coming in 2026. Everybody is kind of writing, you know, expectations, what this is looking at, investors, service providers. We ourselves are putting out a piece like that. But we thought we need an independent voice about this. We need to hear from an academic, someone that is not directly involved in the investment flow, that has been looking at sustainability and has been looking at sustainable investments and can give us a more objective view of what is going on. Yanis, welcome to the show, and give us a little bit of background about you, where you're at, and what got you into sustainability in the first place.
Lorenzo, thank you, first of all, so much for having me. It's really a pleasure and a privilege to be on your podcast, and I'm looking forward to today's conversation. Revealing my age here, but as you said, I've been in this domain for quite some time now. In fact, I've been at London Business School 17 years. And so I've been doing research in terms of understanding the how companies integrate environmental and social issues into the way they do business, and ultimately also looking at how financial markets are evaluating and potentially rewarding or punishing these efforts as corporates deal more and more with these environmental and social pressures. So the short story is that my work in sustainability started around 2008, 2009, when I joined London Business School, trying to understand if, you know, as a junior faculty joining LBS at that point in time, I did have, you know, the privilege of getting a job and then reflecting a little bit and asking the question, well, what do I really want to devote my career to? What would really sort of get me up in the morning to go to work and really explore and research the topic? And so at that point in time, as some of you may recall, it was 2008, 2009. It was at the heart of the financial crisis. I did have a peripheral interest at the time, looking at what was then called corporate social responsibility. But then, of course, the financial crisis for many people kind of triggered this question and this realization that, of course, the corporate world can and does have a massive impact that can be both positive and negative. And at that point in time, and by reflecting, what really excites me in terms of understanding more, in other words, in developing more understanding, I thought about, well, why am I at the business school? Why do I study business? I would like to understand its impact on the world, and how can, in fact, thriving businesses potentially implement that positive potential and ultimately perhaps help us deal with the world's largest environmental and social challenges. So that's how the sustainability focus came about. Started working with co-authors that were at similar stage in their career. We found purpose in what we did. And as they say, the rest is history.
Yes. And is there any particular piece of research or in these 17 years that you feel has kind of been particularly important for the industry to reflect on the role of sustainability at large?
Well, Lorenzo, you know that when you ask an academic for a favorite piece, it's like asking a parent for his favorite child. it's really difficult to pinpoint. I think that, you know, I would like to think that over the years, my research and with my co-authors has had a sort of a logical progression to it. In other words, we started looking at in 2009, some of the first kind of work was looking at the interface between corporates and financial markets. In other words, one of the first papers that we wrote was actually what is the impact of what was then called CSR ratings on analysts' investment recommendations. That piece, when we started looking at how do analysts react to that CSR data, some of the early work that looked at precisely, well, what was an emerging kind of data back then, which was CSR data in the sense that financial markets were using it. And also, to be honest, it was one of the first interactions that I had with also the world of media and the world of practitioners. It was the first kind of very robust feedback that we got. This is a very important question, and I'm glad that you're looking at it. So that's why I think, not only because it chronologically was the first, and then sort of inspired us to work on more papers, but understanding how to investment analysts at the time, you know, we've shown in this paper that the short stories that not only were traditionally investment analysts, not only were they not indifferent to CSR, but actually there were periods where they penalized CSR. They looked at it as a distraction from the usual shareholder value maximization. So if this company is doing CSR, they must almost definitely be destroying shareholder wealth. And in that paper, we documented that as the years went by, that negative correlation actually became smaller. And in the early 2000s, it even became positive. So we showed that dynamic, at least with the data we had at the time.
So in a nutshell, your early child, your favorite child.
Yes, exactly.
In a nutshell. The firstborn. All right. Look, let's go into the question of today. So 2025 was a tough year for sustainability and sustainable investments. What do you feel are the main takeaways? You know, did we learn something? Was this a positive exercise for us?
Very important question. If I were to summarize 2025 for sustainability or responsible investment in one sentence, I would call it the year of peak backlash. In other words, it was the year where we realized that the 10-year sort of ride that we had in the markets, in the corporate world, even in the regulatory world, was coming to an end. It was a stark reminder, of course, that progress does not happen in a linear manner. Progress, especially when it's fundamental, it also triggers backlash, it triggers reaction and sometimes negative reaction. And I think that's what we have seen. But I would also highlight that I call it peak backlash because it might, let's say, the more recent conversations, in other words, the last 2 or 3 months of the year, I also feel that the community and the world might be turning a corner in the sense that conversations are now focusing precisely, as you asked, what have we learned from this year? And ultimately, how will the day after the backlash finds us? There was many silver linings, in my humble opinion, in terms of what we've learned through this backlash. We've learned who is committed and who is not. We've learned that the traditional business case was a fantastic entry point in terms of developing the language of how to speak about sustainability in business terms, in corporate terms, in investment terms. But if we start integrating the bigger picture and the science, for instance, think about planetary boundaries or donut economics, then we realize perhaps we should elevate the level of ambition. And as many scholars are already talking about, elevate our ambition to the systems level. In my view, we also learned, or at least I have learned, that the sustainability or investment community, let's call it, cannot stay indifferent or unengaged or disengaged with the underlying politics. Because if eventually we want to move into a system that is more sustainable, both in the environmental and the social sense, well, you do not move systems either in isolation or without a more inclusive stakeholder engagement. So I think, and that engagement is almost by definition a political process. And I'm not using the term political in the sense that, you know, play the short-term politics game of election cycles, but rather in the political economy sense, where several groups that perhaps in the past have been marginalized from the conversation of sustainability, think about trade unions, indigenous people, local communities, sometimes even customers, bringing them into the conversation and looking at this project of realigning the system within its resources, right, as a political economy project. So, that's a long answer. There's a lot of learnings, and I'm only reflecting, by the way, many conversations that I have had with folks, both on the corporate sustainability side and the responsible investment side, in terms of sense making, what we've learned and where we can go from here.
Can we try to double click on some of these and as we do, look at the actual, okay, what can I do about this, right? Me as an investor. So I'm looking at the different things we mentioned, and I'll maybe start from the bottom. So the industry, I think, has gone through a big year of greenwashing. I don't have the numbers, but the numbers of the amount of ESG mentions, drops in reports and information has been quite drastic. One would think the solution is keep doing it, but keeping quiet. What's your answer to that?
I disagree with that approach. I actually disagree with that approach, because if we go back to the point that I was making earlier, that we need to realize that if you wanted to shift the system, you need more alliances and more stakeholders and building that sort of trust, then not talking about it is not going to get you there, in my humble opinion. But I also think, Lorenzo, to your point that, I had that view as well, but it is very important to look outside the US, even EU, UK context, because there is different drivers to this anti-ESG backlash. If we start thinking about responses to it, whether it's greenwashing or doubling down, we need to understand that this is not the same beast that we're dealing with. For instance, in the US, the anti-ESG backlash is part of a bigger cultural war. It's not just an ESG issue. It's the same stakeholders that argue for anti-immigration, racist policies, anti-women's rights, anti-LGBTQ rights, anti-immigration. They are the same bunch of people, or politicians for that matter. And therefore, in the US, this is an issue of cultural wars. In the UK and in Europe, I think it's a very different conversation. Yes, you have a little bit the emergence of cultural wars in some countries, at least. But here we have the issue of discussing what should we prioritize first. In other words, economic development versus sustainability. Some people even here try to convince us that those two things are antithetical. Some say they are not. But it's almost a conversation of priorities. And given the Russia's invasion of Ukraine, it also became a priority of defense versus sustainability. But I mean, take defense, for instance. That's a great example of where actually being sustainable enhances your resilience in terms of defense. Think about, for instance, the energy sector. If we had more renewables and therefore less reliance on fossil fuels, that makes for more resilient defense.
You could argue that more sustainability drives better defense, but do you argue that more defense drives better sustainability?
Oh, that's a fantastic question, and I'm glad that you're asking it. In fact, we have colleagues at London Business School, one of them in the economics department, is a professor of economics called Paolo Surico, and with his co-authors, it actually shows that yes, if the defense budgets are oriented towards R&D, right, towards research and development, yes, they can and they do result in innovations that that make society better. I mean, GPS is the standard example there. So to the extent that some of the defense budgets are used for innovation and sometimes general purpose innovation, I think they can. Also, I mean, it's kind of interesting. I've listened to a talk recently from a defense expert from the UK government, actually, and he kind of said that sometimes when you are at war with he was in Iraq, if I remember at the time, He said, my real battle was with climate because the soldiers couldn't withstand the extreme heat. So ultimately, even in under the Biden administration, if I'm not mistaken, the U.S. Defense Department, right? Well, it wasn't the Department of War at the time, said that climate change is one of the most important risks that defense was facing. So I think, yes, it can go both ways, assuming that defense budgets are more R&D oriented.
Great. Look, we our next episode will cover defense and sustainability. So we'll hold on digging deeper, but thank you. But can we understand, as an investor, if we're going towards more a system approach, which is the other thing you mentioned, what does it mean? What do I do as an investor that changes from what we did till now to next year, for example?
So I will add one more thing to the list, Lorenzo, because it will help me answer the question about investors, which is what we learned about 2025, I think, which included the COP30 that finished a couple of weeks ago in November, is that we are far from a global narrative and a global policy and a global framework that will guide decarbonization. And that is very important, especially as an investor going into 2026, because I need to start looking at, for instance, the process of decarbonization as a very regionalized, fragmented story. And that has implications. So, for instance, in the UK, it's almost certain that any sort of decarbonization policy and therefore investment opportunities will have to align with regional development and regional economic policy. In the US, investors should be prepared for what I would call a polycentric approach. In other words, there will be difference across progressive and not progressive states. Think about California and New York, for instance. But there will also be a gap between federal policies and state-level policies. And for those investors that might be looking at other regions, like the MENA region, for instance, there, what we have seen in recent years is state-level driven investment, even when we talk about Saudi Arabia or other Arab countries. So that's a different way of achieving decarbonization, even though in those countries you have a gap between investment approach, national investment approach, versus national policy abroad, as we saw with COP and the failure to agree on the roadmap to fossil fuel phasing out. And so therefore, I would say that the important element is regionalization, essentially, and fragmentation, which ultimately is going to lead to higher coordination costs, more uncertainty. So investors should also be prepared for more policy uncertainty. We haven't even talked about the regulatory uncertainty in the EU, but if you combine that, you know, the CSRD, the due diligence law, and all that backtracking that happens in the EU, then not only geopolitics, but policy uncertainty with respect to sustainability laws and regulations will be a very critical component of what investors should be on the lookout for next year.
Another point you covered was we've learned who's committed and who's not. How did we learn it? And how does an investor know who's committed and who's not?
Now, that's a very big question. So let me start by saying that I do think that investors that did proper due diligence, if whether they were sustainability or ESG or impact investors, in other words, those that did proper due diligence did not only rely on ESG data sets and so on and so forth, perhaps those that actually engaged with companies directly, I would say that they already knew who was committed and not. In other words, those that did the smart thing before will continue doing the smart thing going forward. But I think what the backlash has revealed is those both perhaps companies and investors that had a fickle commitment towards these issues. In other words, it burst the bubble in some ways, which is normal in the sense that the world has experienced multiple and diverse bubbles. There's nothing unique about sustainability in that respect. We started bubbles with tulips, right? Like ages ago. So, and it's not strange, and we had the dot-com bubble, and then we discovered which of these business models that at the time were depending on the internet were just not going to pay off. People would argue that we are going through an AI bubble right now. So that's what I mean by kind of distinguishing who is real or not. But even then, Lorenzo, I would say there's a silver lining, because in the case of sustainability, and assuming that we agree that we're not on a good path in terms of solving the world's problems, in other words, we are on a disorderly transition that is likely going to be crisis-driven, forcing regulators and investors to be short-term oriented and reactive, right? So in that respect, I would say it's better to find out who is committed and who is not through a backlash, rather than wait for the next climate crisis to hit and discover then who was really resilient or not.
And is the rating world that you analyze now X years ago that you mentioned is your first child, is that the way through which we want to find that, or is that changed as the world moved on?
There's an important role for data. There's no question about that. And data, transparency, and accountability is critical, not only because of what companies do, but simply because these are, as we mentioned previously, very important underlying environmental and social issues. And we need to understand, and that's why I'm personally a big fan of double materiality, we need to understand how these issues affect the ability of companies to thrive, in other words, in a risk management perspective. But we also need to understand what risks are these companies creating. And over the last 10, 15 years, we did make very important progress on how we measure these issues. I think that ESG ratings and rankings are always meant to be part of the investment decision, or corporate decision for that matter, but not the beginning and the end. It's the same way that, you know, of course, investors engage with companies on a whole range of issues, right? Not only sustainability issues, trying to understand, for instance, what is it that, you know, the company's strategy going forward is beyond the financials and the balance sheet that are backward-looking measures. So it is a big part of the equation. We have done a lot of progress. I'm also a big supporter of regulatory efforts, especially in the UK, to regulate the raters in the same way that credit risk rating agencies are regulated, so that there is no sort of too much of a black box in terms of where these ratings and rankings are coming from, because a lot of money is being invested using these ratings. So there's still a long way to go in terms of the improvements that we can. There's always space for improvement. And the other thing, and this is one of the research projects that I'm working on, is really we need to be a bit more sophisticated in understanding the life cycle of these rating systems. In other words, some of them, they start very ambitiously, very high standards, and then they start getting adopted, but then they face this dilemma, you know, how do we grow the membership? And sometimes that might have implications in terms of either lowering the standards or making, becoming sort of big box ticking exercises. Therefore, my argument is that as we consider regulations for the rating agencies, our true north should be, how do we maintain the informativeness and the legitimacy of these systems so that they do not deteriorate into box-ticking exercises?
You're right. There is some level of rating or scoring that's still part of the process, but that their role is diminished significantly, and that now people are really deep diving into what's the underlying data point, what is the underlying signal that actually is driving either my single materiality desire, my double materiality signal. And so that's at least the experience that we're clearly signaling. And I think it's going to be more what we're going to see of in 2026. But look, I think we got a sense of what we learned in 2025. At least I'm hearing, you know, continuation of regulatory uncertainty. Keep in mind original differentiation. Make sure you communicate what you're doing and don't greenhash. Be aware of the system change and evolve the way you're doing because of system change seems to probably be the big takeaways here. Am I missing something on 2025, or can we shift?
I think that's quite a long list. So I think we're good. I think
Okay, excellent. So look, 2026. So these are kind of our lessons. So what do you think in a year's time, when we look back at 2026, you think are going to be the most interesting developments.
Risky business to try to predict the future, and especially in the world that we live in, that you know, anything goes. But I do think that it's going to be more sort of extrapolating from these trends going forward. In other words, I do expect that these, for instance, the fragmentation around the world, it is going to make the work of investors much more difficult. It's going to make the work of governments much more difficult in order to, for instance, in the EU, align regulation. We're going to see the development of, I think, for lack of a better word, I would call them regional narratives. We're not going to see, in a sense, a world moving at different speeds, but rather we're going to see almost a different socio-political approach to dealing with climate and other issues. I do think, though, that having spoken to so many people and attended a number of practitioner conferences, that some of the issues within sustainability, for instance, nature-based solutions, initiatives like the TNFD measuring not only biodiversity, but anything nature related. I think those initiatives are going to gain traction because despite the politics, what I am sensing is that both corporates and investors are realizing that climate is a huge issue, of course, and will remain, but it's not an independent issue. There's huge interdependencies with issues like deforestation, the collapse of biodiversity, and those are also connected to things like the plastics pollution, the acidification of the oceans. So I think that reality in the new year may push both companies and investors to see the interconnectedness of these issues and elevate, or at least try to elevate, the understanding of non-climate issues to the same level, or at least towards the same direction as climate issues. I think that's going to be a big trend going forward, which has implications for investors in the sense that perhaps we should be accelerating the measurement and understanding and depth of the other issues to bring them to the level of climate. By the way, that includes all the social issues. For instance, we have a long way to go on human rights, on modern slavery or forced labor. Those are significantly lagging behind environmental issues. And that's also going to be the challenge for governments. And on the government front, I would also say, and I think this came strongly, I would say, out of COP30, is that we need to start looking at this duality of mitigation versus adaptation. I happen to be one of those, we don't call it pessimistic, but perhaps realistic folks that think that the 1.5 degrees of global warming, we're going to burn through that. And therefore, talking about adaptation, especially in the developing world, especially in the most vulnerable countries, should be almost as an equal footing with mitigation. So that's another area where, as an investor, I would be looking at.
This year, we've seen either the collapse or the significant reduction of ambition in some of the net zero initiatives. Are coalitions dead, or how are they going to evolve this coming year? And what would you encourage investors to think of as they come together to do without falling foul of, you know, issues that have to do with acting in concert or things like this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the coalitions are fundamental, right? Because we are talking about collective action issues. So whether we talk about collaborations or partnerships or alliances at the level of industry or even at the level of governments or even globally, it's fundamental. And for me, it's an essential element of multilateralism, right? Whether it happens at the government level or at the industry level. So I think that's essential. We cannot do without. That's my starting point. Now, you're right, of course, that the net zero alliances have run into trouble last year, especially if you look at the asset managers, for instance. These alliances, it was, you know, part of the 10-year ride that we were talking about earlier, and the enthusiasm of of joining forces in order to really move the needle. It is, in my view, unfortunate that they were, as it turns out, they were so susceptible to the politics, and therefore, especially once the negative winds started blowing from the U.S., a lot of these alliances, you know, you get the sense in which they are kind of disintegrating. However, one of the alliances that hasn't disintegrated is, of course, the Net Zero Alliance of the Asset Owners. Last time I checked, this is asset owners that control a little bit over $9 trillion. And I think that is very important because if you think about it, asset managers or banks and so on, they manage money, but it's not their own money. Asset owners are the ones that have the money. In other words, those are the ones that could negotiate mandates with asset managers. And in the mandates, it's almost like it's a way of almost overcoming the so-called discussion about fiduciary duty. Because if your client tells you exactly what they want to achieve with the money in the mandate, then that concern goes away. If I'm not mistaken, and I've looked into this a little bit, is there's no comparison between the level of attrition that the other net zero alliances had compared to the asset owners. They're still going strong. They had, I think, only 3-4 members over the last X number of years that left the alliance. So for me, that's a very important positive signal in terms of how these alliances can work. By the way, I think that the issue of coalitions or alliances, we are going to see functioning at the country level as well. And that's because of the politics and sometimes the geopolitical situation. And we already see, for instance, the divergence of the European Union from what the US is doing in a number of ways. This is going to be an important divergence, I think, because lest we forget that Europe is the place of the vast majority of responsible investment is in Europe. This is something that is looked at very negatively in the US. I'm not sure if you have read the so-called national strategy document that came out this week, but it literally includes climate change in quotation marks when they talk about the energy transition and say, you know, the European countries are screwing themselves by committing to climate change, literally in quotation marks. That's indicative, I think, of the gap that we're going to see. And therefore, regional alliances are going to be important. And then the last thing I'm going to say, Lorenzo, is that these alliances are also important because, like we saw in the case of the IMO, we're going to see the US acting in rogue ways. In other words, being the international bully on these issues. And the way to deal with a bully is through these alliances. So that's going to be important both in the economic and the political and the sustainability arena as well.
A lot of the listeners are sustainability professionals, and it's been a tough year also in terms of holding on to your job and reflecting, is the expertise that I built really something that the market wants or needs? Now, I know you've looked into this. Where do you see this expertise go in 2026?
There is no question that 2025 was a difficult year. I have personally spoken with many people who lost their jobs, who had their budgets cut, but also that were demoted in terms of, you know, no longer being in decision rooms. And I totally understand that. But again, I would say that I've seen that more with companies that are heavily dependent to the US or had huge exposure to the US. There's many other parts of the world where that has not happened. For instance, if I look at the Nordic countries, I wouldn't say that was, you know, to that sort of extent the hit of the anti-ESG sentiment. If I were to look at Southeast Asia, for instance, and the state of sustainable development discussions there and the use of ESG, I wouldn't say it was as bad. Even if I were to see the Middle East, if you think about the Abu Dhabi Sustainability Week, the Dubai Sustainability Week, and so on and so forth, the term ESG is alive and kicking in those parts of the world, at least as far as I understand it. Therefore, which for me, thinking about skills in 2026, first of all, it's important to understand that there is a community, and that community has become, in my view at least, more resilient through this. In fact, if you speak to many veterans, people that have been here, been in this community for 30 or 40 years, they say, this is not the first time. In fact, I went to an event with Kaleidoscope this week, and rightfully so, they were calling it the sustainability winter. It will come to pass eventually. So veterans of the sustainability movement would actually tell you, been there, happened before, but there is optimism because the problems have not gone away. Yes, it's rough waters now. The other thing I was going to say, Lorenzo, the one, I think, fruitful way of navigating this period is to think about, okay, given all my experience, what skills should I be building either personally or organizationally so that when the world actually wakes up, and it's going to be very soon, by the way, wakes up that to the fact that, you know, politics cannot negotiate with Mother Nature. These problems have not gone away. They are getting worse. The conversation will eventually reset. What skills do I need? What skills do my company need in order to be best prepared when the world comes back to its senses?
I've heard you talk about this concept of freeing trapped competencies. Is this where you see this happen in practice? In other words, do we have a set of people that have not been delivering because they don't have, or have they not been placed in the role that they need to deliver on?
So thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about that. So for the listeners, let me very quickly explain that concept. The easiest way to explain what trapped competences is to say it is the mirror image of stranded assets. Stranded assets is the downside of the transition towards a more sustainable world. These are assets that are overvalued. These are assets that effectively will diminish in value or even collapse in value if the world were to build a more sustainable economy. The trapped competencies I define as the mirror image. These are undervalued assets. And you can think of those as skills, capabilities. In other words, these are firm-level capabilities that are a fit for a world that is sustainable, but the current system, which is short-term oriented, which is extractive, cannot recognize their expected value, and therefore it misprices them, it undervalues them. And to be more concrete here, we're talking about, for instance, advanced circular economy business models. We're talking about regenerative business models, like regenerative agriculture, for instance, or more inclusive forms of governance. Those are capabilities that we would want our best companies to have if we are to operate in a world that is what Kate Raworth would call in the safe and just zone of the donut, right? So within ecological boundaries and built on a social foundation. I think there are companies that have developed those skills and capabilities, and they are currently frustrated because the system is mispricing them. But again, there's always a silver lining, because that means from the investment side, there are undervalued assets. And as an investor, ultimately, that's what you want to find, right? Find those companies with undervalued assets so that when the world becomes more sustainable, those are going to be the winning companies. There's also an interesting economic argument here to be made, because if those companies, and we talked about coalitions earlier, were to come together and realize, wait a second, we have these competencies and the world may not yet be ready for them. Does that mean? It means that we have an incentive to build alliances that move the system. Yes, there's the norm and normative and the moral aspect to doing so. But here, there's also a strong economic argument, because we want to build a system that ultimately is sustainable, but at the same time, it will make our businesses the thriving, the successful ones. And therefore, that's the idea behind trapped competences. And you're right in noting earlier that that's another an important dimension where now that, you know, the overbearing spotlight, perhaps is not on sustainability, should be asking, what are those competencies? How do we build them? How do we build those alliances to change the system? And Lorenzo, unlike other investments, I would say the following. Look, if you focus on those capabilities, what's the worst case scenario? Well, the worst case scenario is that the world goes on the cutted path. We are faced with a disorderly transition. In other words, climate crisis driven and so on and so forth. Those companies that invest in these trap competencies, therefore, are going to be almost by definition more resilient. So your worst case scenario is more resilience, and your best case scenario, where we have an orderly transition and the system becomes more sustainable, you have, you know, leading profitable businesses that are built on those capabilities. Right? So I think that's an important component of thinking about the upside of the transition, irrespective of which way it goes.
What would be your message to investors in 2026?
Stop funding legacy business models that are based on yesterday's economy or yesterday's economics, and start finding and investing in business models that are instead based on tomorrow's economy. Right? I think that's as cleanly as you can say.
Perfect. All right. And where does technology fit? AI, technology, you know, there's a lot of talk, bubble, not bubble, good for the world, bad for the world. How does this all come together from a sustainability angle?
Well, there is the question of how it all comes together to begin with, right? Especially we talk about technologies like AI. I'm also a big fan of the work of Daron Acemoglu, who got a Nobel Prize in economics a couple of years ago. And as he says, and as many other scholars say, technology in this sense is not inherently good or bad, in the sense that its impacts are not inherently good or positive or negative. The impacts are going to be crucially depending on the governance that we put around them, right? So in terms of what it would be the impact of these technologies on sustainability, there's huge upside potential. It might accelerate solutions to climate change. It might accelerate inventions in terms of alternative materials. It might take our level of efficiency and use of resources to a whole different level. However, I could make equally bad arguments if it stays entirely with no governance, right? Because it could accelerate exploitation, it could accelerate the use of fossil fuels and so on and so forth. Therefore, I think governance is the most important dimension that we should keep an eye on. Unfortunately, we are now in a world of an entirely unhinged and uncontrolled race with unknowable consequences. And we you know, there was this approach where in the EU there was perhaps more regulation, and in the US there's no regulation at all on AI, and therefore that natural experiment was playing out. But I think that, you know, given that most of these AI firms, not all of them actually, are based in the US, that means they are functioning on a non-regulatory regime. So personally, I'm extremely worried about that. In general, about how these technologies are used and developed, because you have good and bad examples. Think about, for instance, the AI that is now used as part of X, right? Which X became the gutter, basically. And that's actually reflected in the AI that is being used, Grok or whatever it's called these days. So that is a very vivid example of how things can go extremely wrong, perpetuate biases, and make the world a much worse place than it is.
Governance. Great. Thank you. As part of the show, we ask our guests to think of a piece of art that links to sustainability for you, and share it and tell us a little bit why it touched you.
Yeah, I think the piece of art that I would identify is this installation that was called Ice Watch. Is by an artist called, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing the name, but it's Olafur Eliasson. And some of you may recall, this is the artist that got these big chunks of glacial ice and put them in various cities around the world and let them melt there. And for me, that's so powerful in its symbolism, because first of all, for those of us that were blessed to actually see a glacier and see a glacier ice block, it's, for me, it's beautiful. And it symbolizes, in a sense, the beauty of nature that we have all around us. But then that's almost misplaced in our cities and it melts. And so for me, there's the symbolic value of deterioration over time and ultimately extinction, right? Because the ice will just melt. And so you go from the beauty and the stability of an ice block to just nothing, just water that melted and evaporates afterwards. So the symbolism of understanding not only the value of nature, the beauty of nature, and the need to protect it is very powerful. Plus, this idea, at least how I interpreted this, is it's bringing that ice block at the center of a city, almost like putting nature in your face and sort of reminding you that ultimately, everything depends. Your economy, your fancy technology, everything depends on natural resources. And unless you're being reminded of that in an in-your-face daily way, like the ice blocks were in the center of the city, you will never almost realize your responsibility to protect those resources, both as resource value, but also as natural beauty and habitat. And that's why I kind of love that installation.
Fabulous. Thanks, Yannis. Look, last section before we close is some quick fire questions. Sustainability in 2026 in one word.
Resilience, both in terms of personal resilience, community resilience for the sustainability community, societal resilience, given the problems are worsening, and hopefully global resilience.
Harmful for sustainability progress. Hype or cynicism?
Cynicism. Cynicism, because cynicism, I consider the easy solution. It's almost like the solution of being pessimistic. It's easy. Yes, everyone sees the climate and numbers can be pessimistic. What kind of work did you put into that to be pessimistic? So pessimism and cynicism so usually go together. So optimism instead.
Amazing. Better leading indicator of real sustainability performance. Corporate culture or corporate targets?
Culture, hands down. A culture of ownership of the problem, it's fundamental.
One thing investors should stop doing in 2026.
Stop funding legacy business models that are extractive, that have negative externalities, that support the old world.
And what's the flip side of that? What is the one thing that regulators should start doing in 2026?
Radically collaborating and building a backbone to resist rogue states.
And the biggest barrier to sustainability progress today, incentives, governance, or competence?
Governance, absolutely governance, because a weak governance architecture can distort incentives, and bad governance can also overwhelm any sort of corporate competence. So governance again.
Again. And active ownership and engagement in 2026. Will it be less important or more important?
More important, because as companies devise, in my view at least, as companies devise transition plans, these are major transformations and they need external validity and legitimacy. So active investors who engage and support companies in their transition plans are essential.
More sustainable, black tea or matcha?
So here's the big question for today. As it turns out, both come from the same or similar species of tea. And although studies have not found an answer to that question, Lorenzo, I would tend to think it's definitely matcha. You know why? You use the entire leaf. You drink the entire leaf. You don't throw away the waste afterwards. So probably matcha, I would say.
Amazing. Yannis and I caught up a few weeks ago, and he shared his love of matcha. So there you go. So look, I think this is a perfect closing. Yanis, I love the conversation. I really enjoyed it. If I try to think, and I've taken some notes, what my main takeaway is, you know, investors abandon these old business models, look for the future. And as you do so, leverage on technology, leverage on collaboration, but keep in mind governance.
And trap competencies.
So the opposite of that stranded asset concept. So thanks, Yanis, very much for joining.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation, Lorenzo. Thank you.
Great. We look forward to having you over again. And I wanted to thank also Curtis File, who runs a production of the show, the Earworm team for supporting. And really, if you enjoyed this episode, please like, subscribe, and comment. Hope to see you soon on the next show. As I mentioned, this will likely cover defense. And until then, stay wired.